Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning as we continue in our third hour. It is a pleasure to welcome Scott Bach to the program, former board chair of the University of Pennsylvania, longtime CEO of the mergers and acquisitions advisory firm Greenhill & Company, and the author of the new book, Surviving Wall Street, A Tale of Triumph, Tragedy, and Timing, which examines his life in facing crises on Wall Street and, most recently, his resignation from the Penn Board in December of 2023. Again, the name of the book is Surviving Wall Street, A Tale of Triumph, Tragedy, and Timing, and it's a pleasure to welcome Scott Bach to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Scott will be giving a book talk at the Colonial Theater in Canaan, Connecticut on Saturday, the 10th of May. And you can find out more information by going to canaancolonial.com, canaancolonial.com. After what you have been through over the last several years, when did you say, okay, it's time for me to channel the energy and put it into a book?
I thought quite a long time ago that I had a really interesting story to tell, that I'd been on Wall Street for a period where it went from really being almost non-existent, kind of hidden to most people. I mean, I grew up in rural Michigan, so certainly had no sense of Wall Street at all. And even when I graduated from college, you know, the Dow Jones was lower than it was 10 years earlier. It was below 1,000 then. Interest rates were 20%. Mergers were very, very rare. Phrases like private equity and hedge fund didn't even exist yet. And, you know, you roll the clock forward and private equity owns 30,000 companies worldwide. There's a couple trillion dollars of mergers and acquisitions every year at Wall Street, really pervading every aspect of American life, including politics, sports, even education now. So I thought there's an interesting story to tell. I did not realize when I started working on the book that the drama would play out at Penn as it did, but that certainly led to a very interesting and I think somewhat gripping conclusion to the book.
Absolutely. We'll get to that in just a moment. Just the title of the book, of Surviving Wall Street, and you do paint a picture, of course, of a fiercely competitive atmosphere, as I think most of us know and realize, and a fiercely competitive industry. What do you think allowed you to survive that, of what you had instilled in you that made that possible?
Well, I think you have to be able to sort of pivot through the many crises that come along. You know, one of the things I point out is that certainly a large majority of the Wall Street firms that were in business when I started as a young professional are long gone now. So most don't survive. And most CEOs don't get to their own finish line with their reputations really fully intact. I mean, you can think of the many firms that have struggled. Some disappeared, like Lehman and Bear Stearns. But, you know, even others like Citibank and others had some really, really difficult time. So I thought survive. That's why the surviving's in the title, and that's what that's really about. And, you know, for me, I think I happen to be part of a firm that really sort of went against the grain, when the world was consolidated and forming these really mega firms that, you know, offered one-stop shopping, as they called it, to companies in terms of every kind of advice they would need. You know, we went against the grain and said we're going to be small and specialized and very client-focused and very aligned with our clients and, you know, owned by the people who work at the place. And, you know, it did very, very well. So we caught a wave, really, in terms of the incredible growth in merger and acquisition activity and, you know, in client desire for having a firm that was really focused on their needs.
When you look at your time at Greenhill, I mean, you bring it through a tumultuous period of growth and crises, as you mentioned, as well as major deals. But as you tell the story in the book, this really is David versus Goliath story.
Yes. No, it absolutely is. I mean, we literally, when we went public in a very successful IPO a little more than 20 years ago, we had about 100 employees. I mean, we literally competed against firms that had 100,000 employees, you know, so it definitely was David and Goliath. But, you know, as I often say in the book, you know, David wins more often than you'd think when you're going to try to win, you know, a significant client or important piece of business or things like that. So that really is kind of a recurring theme in the book, really, of, you know, kind of developing your career, building your business, surviving, you know, what I describe are really five major crises that our firm and all of Wall Street faced. There was the big long-term capital hedge fund blow up in the late 90s. And then, of course, you had the dot-com crash, the financial crisis, the pandemic, and then the most recent period of the Ukraine war and really the pandemic recovery, you know, igniting inflation and higher interest rates. And I think we're frankly still working our way through that one right now.
At what point did you know it was time to go?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think very few firms survive for long, and very few CEOs get to the finish line with their reputations fully intact. And I think, frankly, as I started writing this book 5 years ago, I became, you know, I wouldn't call it obsessed, but very focused on, you know, achieving the right outcome for my firm, the right outcome for me to sort of segue to a career probably more focused on nonprofit and other activities. And I thought, you know, the world had changed a lot. We were a very, very unusual firm when we started out, and that led to a lot of our success. We had many, many more competitors, most of whom just followed our success and wanted to replicate it. So things had changed, and I thought our firm, our team, bank. And so about 18 months ago, I decided after really 25 years of opportunities to sell the firm that it was the right time to do it.
When you went to, as you mentioned this earlier, and as I said, we would go back to it, but when it comes to the University of Pennsylvania and you served as the Board of Trustees chair, did you have any idea that that would be as tumultuous as it turned out to be? I mean, that you don't walk into that, I assume, assuming thinking that you're going to have the same amount of angst that you had in the day job on Wall Street.
You know, what's interesting is that, I mean, there's a lot in the book about boards of directors and CEOs and how they make decisions and how they work through crises and things like that. And I use a phrase that I coined many years ago in talking to friends who are looking for board memberships and so on, that in the, you know, in the corporate world, that serving on a board is often boring or scary. And it's boring when everything's going great. The CEO doesn't really need your advice. You know, you're kind of reviewing audit reports and other things that aren't all that interesting. But almost all companies go through their period of scary. I mean, if you think about even the greatest, most successful companies, the General Electrics, the Boeings, AIG, biggest financial services company in America before it almost got completely owned by the U.S. government, you know, Citibank, Morgan Stanley, where I worked for 10 years, they go through that period. And funny enough, even before things developed at Penn, I did have a number of references in the book to nonprofit boards as well. I've been quite active in those. I'm still chair of the board of the American Museum of Natural History, and I was chair of another similar, an education-oriented institution in New York City. And so I did have that experience. You know, they also have their periods of scary. And at Penn, while I certainly didn't expect it, I mean, these things tend to sneak up on you after, you know, 20 years of being on that board in a really tranquil period where there was incredible, you know, camaraderie and consensus as to how to drive the institution forward, we ended up with a major crisis.
So when it comes to that crisis, you say in the book, what I saw at stake was nothing short of the soul of the university. How so?
Well, you know, I think when I wrote those words, I thought, you know, I believe them for sure. But I thought, you know, some people are going to think that's an exaggeration. They're going to think that what happened at Penn was really all about a debate about free speech and anti-Semitism. And look, those are important concerns. Anti-Semitism ought to be condemned and dealt with wherever it exists. And certainly, you know, most people are in favor of pretty broad free speech. But I got the sense very, very early, I think long before others did, you know, more than 18 months ago, that really the people attacking our board and presidential leadership there had a much, much bigger agenda. You know, really almost everything to do with how elite university institutions have operated in recent decades. And I think right now you can see that playing out. I mean, there's no one who could think what I wrote really was an exaggeration when you see, you know, actions of, you know, dramatic reductions in important research funding, threats of a significant endowment tax, you know, even taking away tax exempt status, which is, you know, I view as kind of the nuclear bomb of this debate, because if institutions that are in major urban areas, you know, the Penns, the Harvards, the Columbias, had to not only pay property tax, but all the donations their alumni make weren't tax deductible. I mean, it would be really, it's kind of an existential moment for those places. And that's what I was alluding to in the book.
So Liz McGill, who is the president at the time of University of Pennsylvania, goes to D.C. to testify in 2023 before a congressional committee that was probing anti-Semitism on campus. Following that appearance on the Hill, what was your reaction and what was the reaction of many members of the Board of Trustees? Because it seemed like it was a panic mode.
It clearly was in panic mode. And, you know, the last two chapters of my book are really, and the book's a narrative, by the way. It's not an opinion piece. It's not sort of telling people what to think. It lays out exactly what happened. People can make their own decisions about it. But those last two chapters lay out in really a blow-by-blow detail everything that happened in the sort of 10 or so weeks that the crisis was developing at Penn before Liz McGill and then I resigned. And I think that, you know, the testimony was really sort of the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of any hope for board cohesion and, you know, kind of a thoughtful approach to how to proceed and even, frankly, confidentiality within the board. So it really was, from a governance perspective, sort of melting down. And so I then advised Liz McGill that you know, it just wasn't going to work and that, you know, we needed to sort of quietly and appropriately and professionally, you know, help her get out of that situation. And I sort of did that largely behind the scenes, obviously getting the appropriate approvals at the end of that process. And then I stepped on myself. I just didn't think, I mean, the whole hearing was really designed to sort of have a gotcha moment. You know, the gotcha moment came 5 hours and 15 minutes into the testimony, which is an awful long time to be interrogated in sort of a hostile forum. So I have a lot of sympathy for the pressure she was under and the fact that maybe not every answer, you know, delivered the right amount of, you know, sort of emotional and moral and other flavor along with the legal questions to the somewhat legal questions or legal answers to the somewhat legalistic questions that were being asked. So that's why I decided it was just time for her to go and for me as well.
U.S. Representative Elise Stefanik, who is from New York's 21st district and is, not that you care, Scott, but is my congresswoman. I find it interesting because the question is asking of the calling for genocide of Jewish people if that would violate Penn's code of conduct. Did you wince when you heard the question?
I mean, I winced when I heard a lot of the questions because, you know, no one certainly no evidence that anyone at Penn ever called for genocide of any group, certainly not Jews. And Liz McGill had never heard that. I'd never heard that. And also importantly, and here's where the question becomes complicated, is that Penn's code of conduct, student code of conduct in place long before Liz McGill ever got to Penn, says explicitly that students cannot be disciplined for speech alone. Under the law, I mean, and I was earlier in an earlier iteration of my life, I was a lawyer as well. And, you know, that doesn't mean it's unlimited. I mean, I remember the First Amendment law cases we studied. I mean, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. You can't extort. You can't bully. You can't, you know, do a number of other things with the using words. But words alone were not something that could be punished. So I think Congresswoman Stefanik was clever in, you know, waiting until the very end of this testimony and really developing a line of questioning that was very, very awkward. And all three of those presidents gave essentially the same answer. I mean, they each condemned anti-Semitism innumerable times over that 5 hours. So it was no question of that. But they all gave the somewhat, you know, legalistic answer of, you know, it depends. If it sort of morphs into something like conduct, i.e. bullying, extortion, et cetera, given the facts, then yes, it would violate the code of conduct. But if it's just words alone, they couldn't quite get themselves to say that it would be because, you know, I think they understood that no student had been punished for any speech on their campuses for a very long time.
So hindsight is 20/20, of course. Now you look at it and you see what's happening at Harvard. You see what happened at Columbia. And you know that this is a major focal point on for this administration. So with that in mind, what does that tell us about the fight that universities like the University of Pennsylvania have going for them? I'm interested in your thoughts of the playbook that Columbia used versus the playbook that Harvard's using.
Well, I am a strong advocate for the playbook Harvard is using. I don't think appeasement has worked at all. I mean, I think, you know, very interestingly, of course, we had the testimony that you just asked me about of the three presidents who went down. That did not go well. They all gave sort of nuanced answers where they were really being pressured to give black and white yes or no answers. The president of Columbia, who couldn't be there that day, coincidentally, but did get called down some months later. I mean, she took a completely different tact and essentially kind of went down and pleaded guilty and was conciliatory and even named some names of faculty that were troublesome and, you know, and sort of made some promises and so on. And, you know, not only did that make her very unpopular back home at Columbia, but she got no benefit out of that. There was no mercy shown. I mean, she still was under tremendous pressure to go. So I've been hoping, and part of the reason, frankly, I resigned is I wanted to be able to speak out on these issues. And you can't really do it if you're, you know, in a formal position, a chairman, CEO, something like that. I mean, you have to speak for the institution. I had thoughts on this. I've written op-eds. I've spoken out. Now I've written a book. And Harvard is following, you know, the path I would like to see universities follow by being, you know, pretty bold in defending their values and defending their rights. I also give a lot of credit, for example, to the president of Wesleyan, Michael Roth, who's been speaking out for really weeks and months on this topic. And, you know, more recently, the president of Princeton did. And I frankly think those things helped. I think courage can be contagious. And I think Harvard saw those developments and thought, you know what, we're not going to be alone if we fight this. And so, you know, they took a hard line. And since then, there is a letter that now hundreds of university leaders, I mean, everything from community colleges to Bible colleges to seven of the eight Ivy League schools have signed, basically pushing back on the federal government's efforts.
What's the end game for the federal government, do you think? What are they up to? What started all this?
I think that there are people who felt for a very long time that colleges are too left, they're too woke, DEI went too far, you know, all those kinds of phrases and lines that you hear. And I think there's a desire to sort of crush that, and you can crush it in part by seeking changes, seeking control, trying to change who gets admitted, trying to change who gets hired on the faculty. You can change that by just taking away a lot of money and really putting financial pressure on these places. So that the objective is a pretty broad one. And, you know, I think you step back and you think, you know what, these universities, and I'm not talking just the Ivies, I mean the top 25 or 50 or whatever number you want to think of. I mean, America's blessed with extraordinary universities. People come from all over the country and all over the world to go to those places. And I think part of the reason the American economy has really pulled away from the rest of the world over the last generation is our universities. I mean, if you look at who runs those various companies and who leads the research, who has the breakthroughs in pharmaceuticals and, you know, in internet technology and telephones and AI and all the rest, I mean, those are people who come from those schools. So I think it would be tragic if the best schools in America got essentially, you know, beaten down, starved of funding, et cetera, to the point where they couldn't deliver the results they've delivered for the last generation.
So let me ask my final question, which is, I think is key to this, which is, but what you just described, which I fully understand and I agree with you, what you just described is far different than what is being described by the administration. And even as you were depicted in an ad that came to your attention that you write about, where a narrator is asking a question in this solemn voice, President McGill, Chairman Bok, how did you let anti-Semitism and hate flourish at Penn? That's much different than what you just described.
It is, but, you know, but I think, I mean, there's a, if you look at the latest letter that was sent from the federal government to Harvard, there's a great piece in The Atlantic right now that talks about how it really takes off the mask and makes clear this is not about nearly about just anti-Semitism. It really is about crushing the kind of the liberalism of these leading schools. And, you know, look, Penn, we had really, in 20 years up until this incident, I had never heard anyone claim that Penn was a school with significant anti-Semitism. I mean, for like two-thirds of the last 50 years, Penn has had a president who happened to be Jewish, which is wonderful. They appointed the first one in the Ivy League. And so there were plenty of people one could have gone to complain. But it was only in this instance where that arose. And there were anti-Semitic incidents that developed out of the, you know, the battle, kind of debate about what's going on in Israel and Gaza. And in each case, we investigated, we punished, disciplined, even got people arrested where that was appropriate and possible. So we absolutely sought to stamp out anti-Semitism, and it would be wrong to suggest that we let it flourish or that it was a really significant problem at Penn.
Scott Bach is the author of the new book, Surviving Wall Street, A Tale of Triumph, Tragedy, and Timing. It is out this week from Wiley. Scott, thank you so much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
It was my pleasure to be here. I'm a regular listener, so it was good to be part of the show on the other end for once.
Oh, very nice. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Be well.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.